This is the BBC.
Order, order.
Hello, I'm Susan Hume, and thanks for downloading the Today in Parliament podcast for Thursday, the 12th of October. Coming up, the government reveals plans to cap energy prices. MPs welcome the attempt to help consumers, but some Conservatives are uncomfortable.
I'm naturally suspicious of caps, particularly being introduced by a Conservative government.
I want to escape this Marxist universe.
Also tonight, the Trade Secretary says there's no difference between himself and Philip Hammond over planning for a no-deal on Brexit.
The Chancellor says that we need to spend money only as necessary. I think that's correct.
Violence at a high-security jail. Opposition MPs condemn prison officer cuts.
Could he explain how new raw recruits are being prepared to cope with the frankly lethal results of long-term cuts in English and Welsh prisons?
But first, the Business and Energy Secretary, Greg Clark, has unveiled the government's plans to cut energy bills for 12 million households, with a temporary cap on prices. A draft bill will give the regulator Ofgem the power to cap the more expensive standard variable tariffs. Around 70% of households don't shop around for cheaper deals and simply stay on that tariff. A report by the Competition and Markets Authority has said the sector is making excess profits of around £1.4 billion a year as a result. Greg Clark told MPs the government wanted competition to thrive, but...
When £1.4 billion a year of detriment to British consumers is identified following a thorough investigation, we have a duty to act.
Greg Clark said the cap would ensure vulnerable customers were not hit by the worst excesses of overcharging.
It would initially last until the end of 2020, with the potential to be extended by up to 3 years if needed. The draft bill would preserve the ability for the market to act competitively. There should be savings for customers on high-priced standard variable tariffs, but enough headroom to allow for effective competition and to give a reason for people to shop around.
Now, Labour, led by Ed Miliband, had proposed an energy price freeze in its manifesto for the 2015 election. The Shadow Energy Secretary, Rebecca Long-Bailey, welcomed the Conservatives' conversion to the idea of a cap, but it wasn't the complete answer.
Does the Secretary of State accept that a price cap, although welcome, is only a sticking plaster and radical reform of the market is necessary?
Labour now proposes to renationalise energy supply. So she wondered, what was the government's solution? It needed to be more than a review.
This cap is only guaranteed for the next two winters, and homes and businesses up and down Britain face a bleak winter, and it seems further ambiguity and uncertainty regarding the government's clear position on price caps mechanisms and the wider market reforms that our energy market desperately needs.
Greg Clark said Labour's renationalisation proposals would inevitably be expensive for taxpayers, and Labour had previously made no effort to tackle prices. Ed Miliband, a former energy secretary himself, got up a few minutes later to remind the minister what David Cameron had said about Labour's proposed price freeze.
Given that this policy was once described from that dispatch box as a con, a joke, disastrous and living in a Marxist universe, it will be churlish not to welcome his conversion to it today. Well done. He is very welcome to the party.
Greg Clark said Labour's proposal would have frozen prices at a time when they were falling. But another former energy secretary, the Lib Dem, Sir Ed Davies, said that as a minister, he'd been advised that a price cap could mean higher bills as energy companies increase their prices to take account of the cap.
Will he confirm that without a cap, we've seen competition expand dramatically, switching numbers soar, and a sustained reduction in the number of consumers on variable tariffs? Isn't the real reason he's gone for this temporary and timid price cap that he doesn't really believe in it?
Greg Clark insisted he'd been determined from the outset to eradicate the market abuses. Alan Brown from the SNP welcomed the price cap, but a number of Conservatives were anxious about the idea of interfering in the market. Some welcomed the government action, but still stressed the importance of real competition. This was William Ragg.
I hope that there is no state monopoly on
Marxist metaphors, and if I might be able to paraphrase Trotsky, the ends we agree on, it's the means of getting there. So in welcoming the draft bill and urging a consideration of a relative cap, will my right honourable friend reaffirm that it is still competition within the energy market that is crucial for consumer choice and keeping bills down?
Yeah.
Other Conservatives, though, sounded more worried. This was Sir Desmond Swain.
I want to escape this Marxist universe. We cap university fees, and lo and behold, all the universities charge the maximum. Can he persuade me that electricity will be any different?
And Robert Jenrick joined in.
There are still some people who believe in free markets. Yeah. It's a lonely life, but I try to bear it with good grace. So I'm naturally suspicious of caps, particularly being introduced by a Conservative government.
Like Sir Desmond, he was worried that prices would bunch up around the cap and that consumers would get complacent, believing that the government would ensure they'd get the best price. Greg Clark promised him that there was nothing to stop companies offering customers cheaper deals and the cap was only temporary.
We agree very strongly that the best way for markets to serve consumers, to bring down costs, to promote innovation, is to have vigorous competition.
And that, he said, was Ofgem's core duty. Now, the EU's chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, has said there's not been enough progress in the Brexit talks to move to the next stage and discuss trade as the UK wants. He said there was new momentum, but there was deadlock over how much the UK should pay when it leaves, and he called that disturbing. The Brexit Secretary David Davis has insisted considerable headway had been made. Back at Westminster, the International Trade Secretary Liam Fox told MPs there was no difference between him and the Chancellor over the need to spend money on preparing for the possibility of there being no deal. Here's Sian Grzeczek.
The Prime Minister appeared to contradict the Chancellor, Philip Hammond, when she said the government was ready to spend whatever was needed to make sure the UK was ready to leave the EU. Mr Hammond had told MPs any funding for a no-deal plan would not happen until the very last moment. At question time, a Conservative, Sir Edward Lee, wanted some clarity.
What happens if there is no deal and we leave the single market at the end of March? Can he inform the House that the Treasury is giving him all the resources he needs to prepare for no deal in terms of preparing schedules, making deals with other countries? This is absolutely vital.
The International Trade Secretary Liam Fox said he had an agreement with the Treasury which would allow him to increase the size of his department to deal with Brexit.
We want to ensure that we will get a good deal, but there is no difference between the Chancellor and myself. The Chancellor says that we need to spend money only as necessary. I think that's correct, but we also need to be sure that we spend money on all areas where contingency plans are necessary.
Another Conservative, Henry Smith, pressed the Trade Secretary.
In its Brexit negotiations, the EU Commission seems hell-bent on damaging the remaining member states' economies. So can my right honourable friend say what preparations are being made for no deal?
Liam Fox tried to reassure his colleagues.
Mr Speaker, across government we will make our plans on contingency, but we continue to hope that the European Union will come forward with a proper commitment to entering into the second part of the trade deal as we think is in our mutual interests.
But the SNP's spokesperson, Hannah Bardell, called on the government to publish a report on the potential impact of Brexit on business.
We know the Secretary of State has consulted the business community to find out how it will affect them. But will he commit today to publish the findings, as called on by a range of MPs across this House, even if the findings show that business wants to stay in the single market and customs union? At what point will this government stop governing in secret and publish the reality of the impact of Brexit?
Liam Fox said the government was extremely concerned at any perceptions of instability.
And we will consult widely, particularly when it comes to new free trade agreements. But of course, the greatest threat to instability, particularly in Scotland, is the insistence of the Scottish Government on threatening a second referendum on independence.
Labour's Barry Shearman wanted ministers to visit what he called the real economy.
In places like Huddersfield, where we have a strong manufacturing sector, will he come even to the city or to Leeds, where we have a financial sector? And not one person I meet in those sectors wants us to continue with this folly of Brexit.
Answering that was the Trade Minister, Mark Garnier, who reminded Mr Shearman that 52% of voters had wanted to leave the EU.
I, you know, was a Remainer. But we have to uphold the fundamental principle of democracy in this country. And it is the job of all of us in government to ensure that we do our level best to embrace the opportunities and the optimistic opportunities that Brexit presents.
But the Shadow Trade Minister, Bill Esterson, said the prospect of Brexit was already harming the economy.
The government's own figures show a 9% drop in the number of new jobs created through foreign direct investment projects and a record trade deficit in goods exports. So in the real world, that means thousands of workers losing their jobs, as we've seen at BAE Systems, Mr Speaker. So does he accept it will take a fully aligned trade and industrial strategy to protect jobs in this country? The current policy of relying on a falling pound is simply not good enough.
Mark Garnier hit back, saying there were record numbers of people in work in the UK.
Since the Brexit vote, we are seeing a huge number of investment projects coming into the UK that are creating new jobs. There is doom mongers like myself, Mr Speaker, who during the referendum were part of the Project Fear campaign, have been proved wrong. And I think it's important that we stand up and say, so far, we have not got this right. And that is incredibly good news for both Britain and our individual constituents.
As for the question about the need for fully aligned industrial strategy, Mr Garnier said that the whole of the government was working together.
Sian Grzeczek there. Well, away from Parliament, a former Chancellor, the Conservative Lord Lawson, called for Philip Hammond to be sacked, saying that what he was doing was very close to sabotage. But in the Lords, another Conservative and former MP, Lord Cormac, took the opposite view.
By odds, are we not singularly fortunate in having a Chancellor who is entirely sensible and optimistic, who looks forward to a good deal, who realises that no deal would not be good for this country, and should we not give him every possible support?
The Brexit Minister, Lady Ainley, agreed.
Yes, my Lord, just as the whole of the Cabinet is in the same frame of mind.
A Lib Dem, Lady Ludford, returned to Theresa May's recent speech on Brexit in Florence, describing it as opaque.
If we are hoping that the European Council next week will at least widen the mandate of Mr Barnier a little in order to prepare for phase two, wouldn't it be wise to actually put some figures on those sums?
Phase two being the talks on a future trade relationship. Lady Ainley replied that it was a technical matter which would decide the future of the UK and the EU.
One doesn't go into that kind of negotiation by just opening the doors of the Treasury and offering a certain number of millions or billions of pounds.
Every penny paid, she said, had to be justified. For Labour, Lady Hayter was concerned that the talks on trade could be pushed into next year.
British Chamber of Commerce says further delay in opening trade talks risks a lose-lose scenario. So how many more warnings, dire warnings, about what this will do to the economy and the jobs does the government need till they start negotiating seriously?
That was a political decision, said Lady Ainley.
I and my colleagues have been engaging across Europe in setting out the reasons why we think it's right for the economy of all countries of Europe that we move to that negotiation swiftly.
Lady Ainley there. You're listening to Today in Parliament on BBC Radio 4 with me, Susan Hume. Still to come, who is Speaker's pet?
We have a cat called Order.
Well, before that, last night's violence at the high-security prison of Long Larton was a very rare occurrence, a Justice Minister has told MPs. 81 inmates were involved in the disturbance, which was brought under control in the early hours of the morning. But Labour said overcrowding and staff cuts meant prisons were less safe. Rachel Byrne reports.
MPs were told that the disturbance was contained within a single wing, with no injuries to staff or prisoners. The Justice Minister, Sam Gyimah, said the incident would be properly investigated.
We cannot speculate on the cause of this incident, but we know that the prison was running a full regime and that this was not linked to any shortfalls in prison officer staffing levels. Its last inspection report found it to be a calm and controlled, and although there were improvements to be made, they felt that the prison was both competent and effective.
But the Shadow Justice Secretary, Richard Bergen, attacked the government for, he said, forcing through prison budget cuts in recent years.
One in three of our prisons have lost frontline staff this year alone. So does the minister believe that fewer and fewer staff dealing with more and more dangerous prisoners leaves prisons more safe or less safe?
Sam Gyimah said the government was investing in prison staff.
We're investing £100 million to add 2,500 prison officers by the end of next year. We are on track to deliver that commitment. This year alone, we have added a net new 868 new prison officers.
On Wednesday, Michael Spur, the head of the Prison and Probation Service in England and Wales, said he was not planning any prison closures in the next 5 years, a point picked up by Richard Bergen.
The head of the prison service ruled out shutting down and selling off dilapidated Victorian jails across England and Wales. This amounts to a shelving of a 2017 Conservative general election manifesto promise.
Sam Gyimah said the commitment to close down old prisons remained within the course of this parliament. For the SNP, Joanna Cherry said there had already been record investment on modernising prisons in Scotland.
Will the minister accept an invitation from me to visit prisons in Scotland to see the good work that has been done there to avoid this sort of trouble?
Yeah.
Plaid Cymru's Liz Savile-Roberts said the minister's talk of a prison officer recruitment drive was all very well, but assaults on staff were at an all-time high.
Could he explain how new raw recruits are being prepared to cope with the frankly lethal results of long-term cuts in English and Welsh prisons?
Sam Gyimah took issue with the MP's description of new staff.
These are not raw recruits. These are, in some cases, people who are bringing new experience to the prison service. In the Second World War, you could be a bomber pilot, you know, at the age of 20. I think you can serve in the prison, you can serve in the prison service at the age of 21 as well.
The Conservative Bob Neill, who's chair of the Commons Justice Committee, raised what he said was an underlying issue, the volatility of the prison population.
Will the minister confirm that he is prepared to revisit some of the recommendations made in the Justice Select Committee's report on prison safety in the last Parliament and look again, perhaps, at the way in which we handle some of the issues both around security and issues such as mental health and the way in which we sentence and treat some vulnerable offenders who get into the prison population?
The Liberal Democrat former Cabinet Minister, Sir Ed Davey, said the Prison Governors Association had described jails as full to bursting.
So in the lowest category prisons, will the minister consider trying to deal with this overcrowding and reduce prison numbers in a safe, sensible way by introducing a presumption against short sentences, as has been successfully implemented in Scotland?
Sam Gyimah said it wasn't for ministers to write sentencing policy. The Conservatives, Philip Davis, said they could change the law, though.
So that anybody involved in any riots in prisons, any assaults on prison officers or attacks on prison officers, are no longer eligible for early release and have to serve the full sentence handed down by the court.
Sam Gyimah replied that if a prisoner was responsible for a crime in jail, they would be prosecuted. He said that was a fair and just way to deal with this kind of situation.
Rachel Byrne reporting. Now, period poverty is the term used for the situation where women and girls can't afford to buy sanitary products. Raising the issue at question time was Labour's equality spokesperson, Paula Sheriff.
Schoolgirls in Yorkshire and elsewhere have had to use toilet paper and even socks stuffed into their underwear because families can't afford sanitary protection due to poverty pay and welfare cuts. Will the Secretary of State consider matching our commitment to set aside funding to tackle period poverty and ensure girls never miss out on their education just because they're having periods?
Yeah.
The Minister for Women and Equalities, Justine Greening, replied that schools already had discretion over how they spent their money and could make sanitary products available to disadvantaged students.
It's also about making sure that parents understand two things. One, the need to play their role in educating their own children, but also, separately, the very clear-cut duty that parents have to make sure that their children are attending school and complying with the law to do so.
Would.
Labour MPs there shouting disgrace, and Labour's Catherine West took the minister to task.
Her approach is a little harsh in terms of schools having to stump up money for sanitary pads, firstly. And secondly, blaming parents, because, you know, periods are just one of those things. You can't blame parents for periods. Thank you.
Justine Greening stood her ground.
I do think parents have a responsibility to play their role in making sure children understand how they will approach adult life. And I think parents do have a responsibility.
Justine Greening there. Now, the Transport Secretary, Chris Grayling, revealed today that the government plans to spend around £48 billion on the railway network between 2019 and 2024, with greater investment in maintenance and track renewals. Labour's Lord Barclay is the chair of the Rail Freight Group. He welcomed the announcement.
What I find interesting is that the statement of funds available is an 8-page document, four of which are blank. And I'd just like to ask the Minister when he intends to put a few figures in this document.
And he called for a real commitment from ministers to boost the Northern Powerhouse.
Because we've heard over the last few months cancellation of certain electrification projects, then £5 million to go into digitalisation of one line in the Northern Powerhouse. It's a bit as if the government's acting as a kind of pop-up cafe for the railway. I hope we can have a long-term commitment to an industry that needs long-term funding.
The Transport Minister, Lord Callanan, said £13 billion would be spent on northern transport in this Parliament.
We're providing better rail journeys through the Northern and Transpennine franchise and the Northern Rail Project. The train operators, Northern and Transpennine Express, will deliver brand new trains, including more than 500 new carriages, room for 40,000 extra passengers and more than 2,000 extra services a week. By 2020, all the trains will be brand new or completely refurbished. All the Pacer trains will be gone.
Lord Callanan there. Now, the Business Minister, Claire Perry, has declared she is proud to carry the flag for conservative environmentalism. Launching the government's clean growth strategy, she said it was a movement that had started with Margaret Thatcher. Christina Cooper reports.
The aim of the clean growth strategy is to increase the UK's wealth while cutting emissions that are harmful to the environment. It sets out 50 proposals, of which 30 are brand new. The Business Minister, Claire Perry, enthused about the UK's role in tackling climate change.
Since 1990 in the United Kingdom, we have grown our economy by almost 70%, but at that time we've reduced our emissions by over 40%, the best performance in the G7. Yeah. And the latest research shows that the UK was the fastest of any country in the G20 to decarbonise in 2016.
She said it showed that moving to low carbon emissions could go hand in hand with economic growth. Among the measures in the strategy is a scheme to help big firms cut their energy bills and a commitment to lead the world in improving carbon capture and storage. The minister took the rare step of congratulating opposition politicians, including the former Labour leader Ed Miliband and former Liberal Democrat Energy Secretary Sir Ed Davey.
The success I'm talking about today is built on many years of work and, frankly, supported very strongly by colleagues from right across the House. And I would particularly like to highlight the contributions of the Right Honourable Member for Doncaster North, no longer in his place, and indeed the Right Honourable Member for Kingston and Surbiton, and thank them for their efforts both in government and opposition, which I think were absolutely pivotal to getting us to where we are today.
The spirit of consensus was infectious, with Labour's Shadow Business Minister, Alan Whitehead, agreeing that the UK was at the front of the pack in decarbonising the economy.
I also very much welcome, as far as she is concerned, the evident position that she is fundamentally onside on the need to radically decarbonise our country to meet climate change imperatives. I have to say, unlike many of her honourable friends on the back benches on her own side.
And he was curious to know whether the UK would stay within the EU Emissions Trading Scheme, or EU ETS.
Does the Minister agree with me about the importance of the EU ETS in this sector, and can she commit today to work towards continued UK membership of the EU ETS in the future?
The Minister promised that she wouldn't do anything to disadvantage the UK as Brexit was negotiated. A Conservative, Richard Bennion, wondered if she'd had the chance to read a collection of essays by the Conservative Environment Network.
I don't know whether my old friend got a chance to read one on the circular economy by me, actually. Because if she does, she'll realise why I'm such a happy person today.
Because he could see that hardwired across government was the belief that using resources efficiently was an issue for everyone. The minister said she wanted to remind the Commons that the first person to raise the impact of human activity on the climate was Margaret Thatcher.
Who understood the core conservative principle that you take care of what you inherit and you try and pass it on to the next generation in a better form. And I am proud to be the latest person to carry that flag for conservative environmentalism in this House.
The SNP spokesperson, Alan Brown, had a rather different take.
It's interesting to hear that Margaret Thatcher's policy for shutting down coal mines and importing coal was because she had some strategic vision in climate change.
Meanwhile, Sir Ed Davey was touched that the minister had acknowledged his role.
With greenest energy fast becoming the cheapest energy, can I thank the minister for her kind words on my role and in that spirit take the unusual approach in this House of reserving my judgment on the strategy before I've actually read it.
That energy-efficient use of parliamentary time was kept up by the Conservative Sir Desmond Swain.
Will it put my bills up?
The answer, said the minister, was no. And she speculated that Sir Desmond's bills had probably gone down already if it acquired energy-efficient domestic appliances and LED bulbs.
Christina Cooper there. Now back to Brexit, and later in the Commons, during a debate on data protection, Labour's new MP for Warwick and Leamington, Matt Western, gave his maiden speech. His constituency, he said, had voted Remain.
Since the vote, residents and representatives of Warwick University, Jaguar Land Rover and other businesses have consistently voiced their concerns to me about the impact of Brexit. They tell me they simply want clarity and certainty, and urgently. Economic matters of critical concern in their planning. They expect government responsibility, not party infighting. I am confident that they would agree with me. No deal, no way.
Matt Western there. Finally, one of the highlights of the parliamentary year is, arguably, the Westminster Dog of the Year show. MPs bring along their pets for a competition that is at least supposed to be less cutthroat than the usual business of politics. At question time to the Leader of the House, a Conservative, Rebecca Powe, said there was a serious point. It would highlight animal welfare and the government's move to increase the sentence for animal cruelty to 5 years.
And if the Leader of the House has a spare moment on October the 26th, I know the Dogs Trust would welcome a late entry. Indeed, Mr Speaker might think about coming along as well.
The Speaker, John Bercow, looked nonplussed.
I wasn't proposing to enter myself. And I don't have a dog. We have a cat called Order. My son has a tortoise.
The Leader of the House, Andrea Leadsom, said the Speaker actually reminded her of a Springer Spaniel, though she didn't say why. But at least we now know why he keeps calling order, order. And that brings us to our closing headlines from Westminster. The Business and Energy Secretary has revealed details of the government's plans to cap energy prices. And the Trade Secretary has said there's no difference between the Chancellor and himself over spending money to prepare for a no-deal Brexit. I'm Susan Hume. The editor was Simon Jones, and that was the Today in Parliament podcast. Thanks for listening.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.